Thank you. And I have to also thank Amy because she is one of the BJHSP exam graders, in case any of you wondered. There aren't enough of them. So we're going to talk about mead recipe formulation. And first off, you know, mead is a really wide open area for recipes. I mean, if you're talking about a beer recipe, okay, I'm going to make an Irish stout. Okay, the parameters are pretty narrow. You know, the choices of what would probably work out to be an Irish stout are well-defined. If you're designing a mead recipe, and I have to ask, how many of you have ever made mead and designed your own recipe? You have a large variety of honeys to start with, first off. Virtually any fruit, virtually any spice. You could make braggot, which means you could mix any possible beer style with your mead. You can do experimental, historic kind of things. You can do a combination of the above. All of these options are legitimate meads. So what's your favorite one? What would you want to make? Do you want it to be strong, like a sack strength mead, which is the highest alcohol category? Do you want it to be a hydromel, the smallest alcohol level? Do you want it to be sweet or dry? Do you want it to be carbonated or flat? Do you want the balance to emphasize acid, tannin, honey, alcohol? You got all these choices when you're designing a recipe. So what do you want to make? Do you want to showcase some special ingredient that's really, you know, something you'd really like today because of some idea that came to you, that you really want this mead that you're going to make to show? You know, maybe you have some really exotic honey that you just got and you really want to emphasize that in your mead. Or maybe you have this fruit that you just found out about that doesn't grow in North America, but you got a few pounds of that you'd really want to showcase for your friends. Do you have some batch size considerations? Maybe you only have enough honey to make 2 gallons of this mead, or maybe you only have enough fruit to make, you know, 3 gallons, or maybe your equipment only allows you to make 40 gallons. All right. You know, all of these things matter to your recipe. You know, we're used to in the beer world saying, well, it's a 5-gallon recipe and it's easy to scale up. You're frequently going to run into things when you're making mead where you don't have enough of one of the ingredients or your equipment doesn't allow you to do that. So as we start talking about this idea of recipe formulation, there's a couple things to keep in mind. Virtually all the sugar in all the varieties of honey are 100% fermentable. If you've made beer, you know that you can adjust your mash temperature and your grist composition to influence how fermentable or how unfermentable your grist, your end wort would be. If you add crystal malt, you can get a sweeter beer because some of the sugars are unfermentable. That doesn't work with mead. I mean, the honey is all going to ferment. The yeast really likes those kind of sugars. The only way you're going to get a sweet mead at the end is to have enough sugar at the beginning, enough honey, that you exceed the yeast tolerance to ferment. Every yeast that's known has some alcohol limit, and if you get the alcohol level in the mead to that level, the yeast will shut down. Different strains have different levels. So if you exceed that level in the OG of your mead, you're going to end up with some sweetness. The difference between the final gravity and the original gravity, you can look at the various tables in Beersmith or the other tools or your hydrometer, and you say, oh, that's a 14% mead. Oh, wait a minute. The yeast I'm using is tolerant to 18. Whoops, you're going to get a really dry mead. You don't have any choice. It's going to finish dry. Now, there are ways we'll talk about on how you can get it sweeter at the end, post-fermentation, by adding sorbet or pasteurizing. But in general, the sugars are fermentable. So if you look at this alcohol limit table here, and there's more detail on these kind of things in my book, but if you had the listed OG and, you know, starting gravity, I'm sorry, of your mead and your alcohol limit of your yeast is as indicated, it's going to take that mead down to 1.000 on your hydrometer or even lower, really dry. So if your yeast is 8% tolerant or higher and you have a 1061 OG mead, it's dry. The only way to fix that afterwards to get it sweet is to do something after fermentation. By the same token, if you have an 1145 OG mead, this is obviously a sack strength mead, and you have a 19% tolerant yeast. Fortunately, there aren't a lot of those. You can also ferment that much down to bone dry, and it'll be 19% alcohol, so it would be a pretty potent mead. So keeping those kind of things in mind, you know, you'll look at most of the yeast vendors. They're going to give you their view of what the alcohol tolerance of their yeast is. What you'll find is that with staggered nutrient additions, the modern mead making techniques, you can frequently get those yeast to go 1 or 2% alcohol more than the vendors will tell you they'll do. But that's about all you can squeeze out of them, which may give you a lot sweeter or a lot drier mead than you thought you were going to get up front. Next aspect of your recipe formulation, which honey would you like to use in your mead? I mean, there are many aromas and flavors in your honey. You know, you can think of seafoam honey. It has, sort of a marshmallow character. There's a tupelo blossom. It's a relatively expensive honey. It has some really interesting spicy woody notes. Orange blossom is a very distinctive honey, readily available. Clover is what most people think of honey. I mean, you can go to the grocery store and it's probably clover honey. I wouldn't use that for my mead, but, you know, from the grocery store. But clover honey can be quite nice. Do you want the honey that you use in your mead to reinforce some other ingredient? Do you want it to contrast with some other ingredient? Do you want it to be secondary or primary characteristic in the mead? Is it a varietal honey that's really dominant? How many of you here have actually ever tasted buckwheat blossom honey? It's pretty intense, isn't it? And it's kind of a love-hate relationship with that honey I found amongst the general population and even amongst mead makers. But maybe that's what you really wanted. Maybe that's what you didn't want. Maybe that's what your friend really likes. Maybe orange blossom is a much more neutral base, or clover. Do you want a complex but indistinct set of aromas and flavors from your honey? That's typically what you get from wildflower honey. And unfortunately, what you see in a competition setting, like we judged meads yesterday as part of, you know, the NHC competition, people still list wildflower honey as their base honey. That's meaningless. That means that the beekeeper did not have clear, defined definition of what the floral source the bees went to. To be a varietal honey, that simply has to be the dominant flower that the bees went to was orange blossom, clover, whatever. Wildflower means they had no control or they didn't have a real dominant one. So saying you have wildflower honey says nothing, but usually wildflower honey therefore means it's complex because it has multiple floral sources involved in the honey. But my wildflower honey may be different than your wildflower honey, and the wildflower honey you bought from your favorite beekeeper in the spring is going to be different than the wildflower honey you would get from them from their fall floral sources, because over the course of the season, different flowers bloom at different times, and the bees go to whatever's available, and different flowers provide different flavors to the honey. And that's why wildflower is not varietal, but it's usually complex. An interesting resource if you're trying to think about what kind of honey and what it's going to provide is a relatively new gadget, resource, whatever, from the University of California Davis Honey and Pollination Center. I've only shown a little piece of it here because it is a copyrighted resource. It's the Honey Flavor Wheel. Many of you have probably seen the Beer Flavor Wheel, which was developed by Morton Milgard 20, 30, whatever years ago. And in the meantime, flavor wheels have been developed for many other kinds of food and whatever ingredients like cheese and wine and whatever. Well, this one is a common set of terminologies and characteristics that can be used to describe honeys. And so if you look at this flavor wheel for honey, you can kind of focus in on which kind of honey might be the one you wanted to use for the characteristics it imparts to your mead. And the URL that's on the presentation is where you can order these from UC Davis. I don't know any other sources, I should say, where you can buy one. Next part of your recipe comes down to how much honey do you want to use in your mead. Honey weighs about 12 pounds per gallon, and it does vary a little bit. Honey is normally sold by weight, not by volume, even though frequently 12 pounds fits into a gallon. But if you look closely at the fine print on the label, you may find that it's 11 and 3 quarters pound or 12 and an eighth or whatever, depending on the varietal. Typical honey is 17% water, but that varies. Most bees, when they're working the hive, try to get the honey down to at least as low as 18% water so that it's stable, that it doesn't wild ferment in the hive, because they're actually capturing this honey to be food for the brood that's going to be the next generation of workers. But honey is hydroscopic. Hydroscopic means that the honey will absorb water from the environment. So if you have honey in a container that is not sealed airtight and there's any humidity in the air, that honey is going to keep sucking water out of the air. At some point, you're going to get enough water in that honey that it will now be diluted enough that it can start fermenting with wild yeast. Honey may well have wild yeast in it, but because of the high concentration of sugar, it's stable anyway. Because at that high sugar concentration level, the wild bugs that might want to ferment it can't do well because the osmotic pressure on their cell walls. But as the water gets sucked in from the atmosphere, bad things can happen to your honey. The other way of looking at this, for those of you who are into, you know, points per pound per gallon for making beer, on the average honey, if you add a pound to a gallon of water, you get about, and not to a gallon of water, you add to enough water to make a gallon, because it matters with honey, you're going to get about 38 specific gravity points per pound of honey in a gallon of to make up a gallon of solution. The typical recipe formulation programs that are out there for, you know, doing your homebrew recipes also take that into account for putting honey in there. You know, if you're talking about recipes for mead, obviously we can talk about just traditional mead. Traditional mead in the BJCP terminology is water, honey, yeast, nutrients. That's it. Yeah, there's no spices. There's no fruit. There's no anything else added, no beer, whatever. That's a traditional mead. But if you're making something else, a non-traditional mead, let us say, which means it's a melomel, could be a piment, it could be a sizer, it could just be some other fruit, it could be a braggot, you're adding these things. You're adding fruit, vegetables, spices, specialties, historic things, you know, experimental things. Now you have to think about what exactly am I trying to get out of this? If I'm trying to make an Ethiopian tej, for example, which uses what some people mistakenly think is hops. Their term for hop is actually the gesho plant. But that's the only other thing that's put into tej. It happens to impart a slight green color to the mead. And, oh, by the way, Atesh, you don't put any yeast in because it's spontaneously fermented from the bugs growing on the gesho plant. If you're making a spice herb vegetable type mead, maybe you want to put red beets in. You know, I've actually had one of those once. It was drinkable. I'm not sure I would really make 5 gallons of it, but it was drinkable. I mean, there are lots of interesting things you can do, either as a, you know, subtle character, or really you want it in your mead, or maybe you want to mix it with a spice. I personally like pickled beets better than raw beets, So now you've got to have to throw in some cloves and, you know, maybe some allspice and some other things with those beets. And just use the beets to give you maybe a bright red color. Just a thought. So if you're looking for ideas, a really, really good reference book is a book called The Flavor Bible by Page and Dornberg. This particular book, they went through and did a survey of many really well-known chefs on which food items went together well. So, oh, cilantro and lime. Oh, that seems to work really good in a certain style of food. Cherries and vanilla, obviously that shows up in here. You know, there are a lot of really unusual ones you might have never thought of. They never tell you the ratios or the amounts to use. It's just that, you know, these are combinations that have worked really well in famous restaurants, for famous chefs, for famous food items. Some of them are probably not going to work in meat because maybe they call for Roquefort cheese and whatever in, you know, as a combination. And that's probably not going to work good in your meat because it's got a lot of fat and oil in it. Some of the other ones are really awesome. But you're going to have to experiment a little bit when you find the item or the pair or grouping of items that sounds good to you, because they're not going to give you ratios. And so you're going to need to hone in on it. But it's a really good source, like I say, to find new ideas for combinations that maybe hadn't hit you before. Maybe you have one really neat thing that you want to use and you want to know what else to put with it. Like, say you happen to stumble across 20 pounds of ripe figs and you want to, what could I put those with? Well, you will find that there's a whole section in this book on things that pair with figs. So if you're doing a fruit meat, a melomel in the BJCP terminology, how much do you need? The general guidance most of the established mead makers, at least home mead makers, would give you is probably 3 to 4 pounds per gallon of mead is a good starting number on how much to use. I mean, there are variations. Some fruits have really faint flavors. I find strawberries are relatively faint. Thanks to my buddy Al Boyce down here and his sister in the produce world, and, you know, several of us had this opportunity to play with a few hundred pounds of strawberries. How many was it, Al?
400.
And 4 pounds per gallon of strawberries is really still pretty delicate strawberry. Now, if you're using black raspberries, 4 pounds in 5 gallons is pretty strong. I mean, it's intense purple at that point. They're not a delicate fruit like even red raspberries. So it varies. There are exceptions, but 3 to 4 works most of the time. A lot of times you can find suppliers that provide fruit concentrate, because if you're a commercial producer of fruit, if they concentrate it, it's a lot easier for them to store and process, ship around. I mean, shipping 400 pounds of strawberries around is kind of a hassle, and they aren't very shelf stable. But if you reduced 400 pounds of strawberries at a commercial scale to concentrate, that's probably only a couple quarts of concentrate. And you can keep it in your fridge, and it lasts a long time. I've bought concentrate from a couple different orchards that have fruits like blueberries, raspberries, cherries, various things like that. Works really good. And, you know, a lot of them are going to be like an 8-to-1 concentrate, meaning that 1 quart of that concentrate is the equivalent of 8 quarts of juice. 8 quarts of juice is 2 gallons. You know, they're not all that way, but that's a real common concentration factor. So one of the things to think about then is, well, if I got 2 gallons of juice, what's that equivalent in real fruit? You have to realize that on average, not all fruits, but on average, fruit is about 85% water by weight. And less than 10% by weight is sugar. Very little sugar in fruit, surprisingly. Well, water is 8.33 pounds per gallon. So if you had 10 pounds of fruit and it's average 85% water, That means that 10 pounds of fruit is a little over a gallon of water in that fruit. Now, say you went and pressed all that fruit. You're not going to get all of it out, but just kind of a ballpark thing. You could say a gallon of juice on average is coming from 10 pounds of fruit. We're close. It's going to vary a little bit by, you know, what the press looks like and what the fruit variety is. So, okay, that's a gallon of fresh juice. So if you concentrated that 8 to 1, that's only a pint of concentrate. So now you can start seeing why at the wholesale commercial level they really like concentrate, because it's a lot easier to move around. It's a lot easier to keep. As a mead maker, concentrate is really nice because you don't have all that fruit pulp and messy stuff to deal with. But if you're using real fruit, you have to take into account how much water and how little sugar you're adding to your mead. So if I'm making 5 gallons of mead and I put, say, 30 pounds of strawberries in there, that 30 pounds of strawberries is adding approximately 3 gallons of water to my mead. If I don't take that into account, my original gravity is not nearly as high as I really thought it was going to be when I just, I put this much honey in this big a batch. And lo and behold, it ferments out way drier than I really wanted it to. And I go, what happened? You know, is my yeast really efficient here? Why did I finish below 1 when I thought this was going to finish with a medium sweet 10, 20 final gravity? It's because all the water that came from the fruit. Unfortunately, when you put that fruit in, you know, say you just cut it up and threw it into your fermenter with your yeast and your water and your honey, you put your hydrometer in there, it doesn't show up right away. It's still in the fruit. You can freeze the fruit before you use it, then let it defrost. Some fruits break down a lot faster than others. Strawberries break down relatively fast. Rhubarb breaks down really fast. I mean, it just becomes, you know, some stringy pieces left over and, you know, a lot of watery stuff. But it usually doesn't show up right away even then. In the wine world, they talk about, well, just wait a day and take a gravity reading again, because most of it is melded together by then, and the yeast really hasn't dropped the gravity a whole lot in that first 24 hours. And so maybe then you can just put your hydrometer in the must and get it that way. It's going to be closer. My technique in my book would be to, you know, take into account and just calculate it up front. But the cellular structure does hold this water. It may hold the sugar. And you're not going to ever get 100% of it out of the fruit. But you probably can get 90%+ out on the average case. And so you can really mess up your thought on where you're going to get your mead to finish because of what the fruit did to you. There's a table in my book which is derived from a couple sources as to, you know, the average percentage of sugar and water in fruits. And like I said, most of them are going to be 85% water and less than 10% fruit sugar. Many fruits are actually 5% or so sugar, which is really surprising. I mean, watermelon is okay, pretty sweet, and it's still around 10 or 11. Another thing to consider, and we kind of, you know, briefly touched on this in the mead panel last session, some fruits have malic acid in there, and there are a couple yeast strains that are able to metabolize malic acid into softer lactic or citric acid. You probably heard that a lot of, at least homemade mead makers, and a few commercial mead makers like Michael Fairbrother at Moonlight Meadery, we like 71B1122, which is also called Narbonne from Lalemann, and another yeast that has a similar property as Vintner's Harvest, MA23. These particular strains of yeast are known for their ability to take malic acid, which is relatively rough, and convert it into lactic and citric. Malic is one of those things, if you take a not totally ripe peach or apricot and bite into it, it's still kind of crunchy yet, so it's not all the way ripe, and you get kind of that tartness. That's usually the malic acid that's causing that. Apples are also real high, or many varieties are high in malic acid. And so these yeasts will soften that harshness out of the fruit, just as part of their byproduct of fermenting, which is kind of nice if you're a mead maker and you're using fruit. Some fruits are really, really high in tannins. In particular, I think of aronia, which is also known as chokeberry, choke cherries, which is a completely different branch of the family tree, and some like wild grapes and a few other fruits are really, really high in tannins. And if you ferment a mead with those fruits in it to bone dry, they are just mouth puckering. They just, you know, it's like sucking all the moisture out of your mouth because the tannins make you perceive a mead or a wine as dry even when it isn't. So I've made aronia-based meads, and people think it's dry. And it's like, oh no, if you put the hydrometer in that mead, it's actually finished at 1040. And if you look at the BJCP guidelines, oh, it's like, if it's at 1040, that's a sweet mead. Well, that's the measured value, not what it's perceived at. And putting a ton of tannin in makes you think it's dry. Then there's the fruits that are really high in acids. Many apples tend to be this way. Raspberries are kind of middle of the road. Most citrus fruits are high in acid. They need a sweet mead as well to come across correctly. Those of you that are at the previous session, our mead panel and Ken Schramm's pineapple mead, as was mentioned, if you made that mead dry, not so pretty good with pineapple. Because of the acid that pineapple imparts, you need to have the sweetness to balance it out. So you need to take these things into account as you're formulating your recipe. You need to have a little understanding of the fruit. Like I said, my book has tables about what kind of acids might be in various fruits. You know, it's not a, you know, some fruits are not so well known. If you have one of those, you might be on your own trying to figure out what they're going to do to your mead. But the other thing is you want to avoid going overboard on how much acid you leave behind for a sweet mead or how much tannin you use. In particular, you'll hear winemakers and mead makers talk about a sweet tart. A sweet tart is a mead that's got a lot of acid, okay, but it's ended up so sweet it's kind of like the sweet tart candy, which has a lot of acids in it and a lot of sugar. And it's really unpleasant in a pint glass. It's not so bad when you're eating a couple little tablets. So if you're going to do spices, metheglin in BJCP terminology, how much is enough? Unfortunately, spices, I can't give you a good rule of thumb because it really varies. It varies based on what spice you're using. It varies with how old the spice is. It varies with how the spice was stored, where you bought it from. I mean, in the cooking community, generally people would say, well, you should throw away your spices once a year because obviously now it's obsolete. You know, it's some people would say every 6 months, but no, most spice plants only produce once a year, so why throw it away at 6 months? Because if you bought new, you've still got as old as the stuff you had. But literally at a year, spices could be getting pretty old. If you stored them in a bad place, you know, if you read the fine print in a lot of your spice containers, this is don't store over the refrigerator or over your stove because those are warm places in your kitchen. It deteriorates the spice for cooking. Well, the same thing happens for mead making. If you abuse the spices, they change. And so the next time you use them, if it's the same spice batch you had before, it's not going to work the same. So if you're using a spice combination you haven't used before, I always tell people to use way less than you thought you need. You can always add more later, but if you put too much habanero in, it's really hard to take it out later. You can blend a lot more to dilute it down, but you can't take it out. And the other thing to think about, I reference a flavor Bible, and they talk about spices in there that could work together. But you also have to take into account with spices that they have properties that influence their extraction. Some spices, most spices, will extract differently in fat than they will in hot water versus cold water versus alcohol or sugar. And so a spice where you extracted it in a food that you're familiar with, where there was a lot of fat in the food as you're cooking it, you may not pick up the same characteristics from that spice when you threw it into your mead in secondary because there was no fat to pull some of those compounds out there. They're only fat soluble, and so they won't go into solution in your mead. Or maybe they only extract in cold water, or maybe they only extract in alcohol. And so that can play a big role in what spices are going to do in your mead. And you're going to have to experiment with that, unfortunately, because every spice is a little different to get to know what you can work. I tell people the way to supplement the spice characteristics in your mead is put a little bit in, you know, probably less than you really think. You can put that in the mead, and now you can supplement later. I would use a tincture. Tincture meaning you take some of the spice, put it in a sealed container with some solvent. The solvent could be water, hot water, cold water. It could be ethanol. I typically use vodka. Everclear would work as well if you can buy it in your state. Or you could take even a mead. Probably any old mead, because you're only going to use a little bit, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 ounces to cover the spices. And you're going to soak the spices in this solvent for hours, days, until it picks up the characteristic. The thing to be aware of is if you're using water or even a mead to do this soaking, you have to watch out about sanitation. If you're using vodka or Everclear, you don't really need to worry about sanitation to process this stuff. Those things are sterile. There's not much can grow in those. The tincture also works as a good way to get oak character into your mead post-fermentation. If you take some medium toast French oak cubes and put it in a small clean jar, cover those oak cubes with a few ounces of vodka, let it set a day or two, and you'll notice that the vodka is really brown, coffee colored at that point. At that point, you can put a couple drops of that tincture into a glass of your mead, and you'd be amazed how much character that vodka carries. You do that tincture with a heavy toast oak, you're going to get more, and you're going to get different nuances, just like you would if you aged in an oak barrel. You're going to get nuances of different toasting levels. And so you can use these tinctures to pick up spices, oak, anything like that. It works really good to use for a post-fermentation adjustment because you didn't put enough in primary, because you don't want to go over the top. You know, say you put a pound of oak chips in your mead, and you get to the end, you go, oh, crap. It's really oaky. It smells and tastes like a sawmill. Oh, at that point, you need to make maybe 3 times as much mead without the oak and blend down. Maybe you didn't want to do that or shouldn't do that. So add later, adjust. Big things to consider in your recipe, again, are your yeast choice. Now, if you hear from the commercial mead makers, you'll find most of them are using the same yeast for all of their stuff. They want to get comfortable with the yeast and use it over and over and over. They know what temperature range it does what they want. They know what its nutrient needs are. They feel comfortable with it. You as a home brewer, we're more adventurous. We'll, you know, make beers with 12, 15 different strains in the course of the year, maybe more. We can do the same thing with our meads. You can use 71B all the time, or you can try, you know, one of dozens of different yeasts, you know, each time. So you look at those yeasts and what's its alcohol tolerance. Most of the vendors will tell you an approximate number. I find that the accuracy, or, you know, let's say the tolerance level of the number they give you varies from vendor to vendor. They will tell you typically what its nutrient level needs are. Say, well, this is medium, this is high, it's low. That usually works good within a vendor set of strains, but if you compare a medium from Lallemand to a medium from Y-Yeast, their medium may mean different things. So you need to kind of become comfortable with the yeast, like make you know, understand why the commercial people would typically use the same yeast all the time once they get comfortable with it. Different yeasts have different temperature tolerances. Some of the wine yeasts in particular will work from like in the mid 40 degree Fahrenheit range up to in the mid-90s, and they don't really care. They've been used for centuries in wine fermentation long before refrigeration was developed. Other ones are very narrow bands they'll work in. Some yeast have very specific aroma and flavor characteristics. They have special aspects. Like I said, 71B and the MA23 in particular will break down malic acid. Some strains are very specific history-oriented things. For example, if I'm making a Chardonnay-based piment, I want to use a Chardonnay yeast strain, a strain that's traditional to Chardonnay, because Chardonnay's character, part of that nutty character that people talk about in Chardonnay, comes from the breakdown of the yeast. It's aged for time on the yeast cake, unlike what we tell people in beer making and most mead making, which is to rack off once the fermentation is done. A Chardonnay is left on that yeast for some weeks or months till it throws that nutty character that that particular strain does. It doesn't, you know, give you that yucky, rubbery character that some other yeast might give you if you left it on it for months. So you want to take those kind of things into account based on the other ingredients you're using. So, okay, say you put together your recipe. You decided this is what I'm going to do. I want this gravity. I'm putting these three fruits in. I fermented with this strain. You fermented it. And now you decided, okay, it wasn't quite what I wanted. You know, hopefully you'll correct for this in your next batch. But you want to fix this. You want to sweeten it, for example, after fermentation. You can back sweeten your mead with more honey. You heard several of us, you know, in the last panel, if you were there. Our preference is not raw honey, even though several of the meads we presented there were back sweetened with raw honey. I personally like blending with a sweeter mead. You could, if it's a melomel and you had fruit in it, you could even back sweeten by adding juice from that fruit post-fermentation. Say you were making a pineapple mead, and it was relatively dry, and you know, as Ken mentioned, that probably doesn't taste so good. So you could back sweeten with some pineapple concentrate to give you the sweetness. The thing you have to worry about with back sweetening is you don't want to restart the fermentation more than likely. Otherwise, it's not sweet anymore. So what do you do to back sweeten and not start fermentation again? The classic technique, it's you know been used for winemaking and obviously to some extent in mead making for recent times. So clarify it first. You want to get as much yeast as possible out of the mead so that it's not able to restart the fermentation. You'll never get it all out unless you have a sterile filter. Most of us don't have one of those at the home mead making level. Then you add sulfite. The sulfite will inhibit any microorganisms, including the yeast that's still left. It doesn't kill things unless you put in really way more than you want in your beverage. But you add that sulfite, it helps stabilize it. Then you add sorbate. Potassium sorbate doesn't kill yeast. What it does is stops the yeast from reproducing. But those cells that are still there are able to make alcohol until they die off. That's why you want to clarify as the first step to get rid of as much of those yeast cells as possible so there aren't many left to ferment your back sweetening into alcohol. After you've done these steps, then you add the sweetener so that there's very little chance of any yeast converting all of your back sweetening into more alcohol and, again, ending up with a dry mead. So that's a classic way, you know, clarify, sulfite, sorbate, sweeten. Other techniques, pasteurization. You know, it's Louis Pasteur had a really good idea. It's about 140, 150 years ago. That was a pretty much of a breakthrough in food science. If you take your mead, beer, cider, whatever, milk, and you heat it to about 160 degrees, hold it for a minute, and can chill it back down, it's pasteurized. You haven't killed everything at 160, but it's enough to last for a really long time. And if you read up on pasteurization, they talk about pasteurization units, which are based on how what temperature you got it at and how many seconds you had held it there. But 160 for a minute is pretty good. It's pretty easy to do if you're also set up to do home brewing in addition to making mead, because you could take your mead, you could bottle it, put it in some bottles. I'd recommend having all your bottles be the same type. Heat some water up. Set your bottles in this hot water. Put a thermometer in one. Take the cap off and watch until the contents of that bottle is at 160. The water doesn't have to be boiling. You just want it hotter than 160. Once you've got that one to 160, okay, take those out of there, and you can chill those bottles. I'd have the bottles capped, all except the one I have the thermometer in, and okay, you're set. Those are pasteurized. They're now stable. That sweetening is going to pretty much last because it won't ferment out. The benefit of that versus the sorbate process is while the sorbate works, sorbate is not long-term stable. Sorbate will break down, and it has some yucky flavors if it breaks down over a year or two. And some people are much more sensitive to that characteristic. Another thing you have to think about, may have to think about at post-fermentation is balancing. As brewers making beer, balance is pretty simple. Balance is kind of bitterness against sweetness. It's kind of like a teeter-totter in the little kid's playground. It's pretty simple to think out balance at a beer level. Balance is not so simple in a mead because you've got tannin. You've got sugar from the honey. You've got acids. You've got alcohols. All these things. It's a complex, weird-shaped piece of wood, maybe, balanced on this little pin. And, you know, there are many ways to get it to balance out. And some of them are easier to achieve than others. So you can add acids relatively easy to your mead to adjust the balance post-fermentation. You know, typical blends would be acid blend from your homebrew shop, which is usually citric, tartaric, and malic probably. Depends on the vendor. Citric, malic, tartaric all work to adjust the acid level of your mead. You can add tannins, again, to add structure, mouthfeel to your mead and help balance it. Many forms of tannin, though, are not instantaneous like acid. If you read Scott Labb's book, catalog, whatever, on tannins that you can add to your mead, some of them, they say, oh, add this 2 weeks before bottling, add this a month before bottling, add this at this level, because they know that certain formulations drop out or combine slowly. And so they give you different suggestions. I mean, historically, people say, oh, there's tannin, it's tannin, and you just add a tannin to your mead. Yeah, it's not so simple anymore. There's lots of choices. In general, if you're trying to adjust balance, it's much harder to reduce acid and tannin in your mead than it is to add. You can reduce acid, but those kind of chemicals, if you add them, they react with the acid. They're called bases. But usually the salt that's the result of doing that has some other negative flavor characteristics. So you try not to do that if you can. Tannin removal, there are techniques, findings that will remove tannins. But again, they're kind of a pain in the butt and not usually at the homebrew level. There are limits on how far you can shift the balance in a mead before you destroy the mead. I mean, if you have to add, you know, say, a half ounce of citric acid per gallon of your mead, it's probably not going to really taste even as good as tang afterwards. And the dominant thing in tang is citric acid. You have to be careful. You don't want to go overboard in your balance adjustments. Quite frankly, I almost never adjust the balance of my meads after fermentation. They almost always turn out within range. So the last trick you could use post-fermentation is blending. Now you can blend with other meads. You could blend with beers and wines. It greatly expands your options of what you could do with your mead. If you have a mead that's too sweet and you have another mead that's too dry, gee, guess what? You could put them together. Now, what ratio? Okay, you can experiment with that. Works really good to adjust meads. If you're just trying to do a simple numeric adjustment of your mead, you want to lower the alcohol level, you want to raise the alcohol level, things like that. Pearson Square is a classic technique. You can Google for it, or it's in my book on how to blend, where it's like, okay, I want to adjust the alcohol level up by 10%. How much vodka do I have to add? It's easy to calculate that out. Unfortunately, if you're trying to do sensory-based blending, oh, I want to push the balance this way, it's a little harder. That's not done by math. That's done by your palate. So the technique I have in my book, you start with, okay, how about 50%? How about 75%? You know, let's try and hone in on what amount of this addition is going to work to get to the level I want. And balance is your personal thing. I mean, there's a range that's going to work, and then there's the things outside that that are just going to make you gag. But within the good range, you may have a different preference than the person to your left or your right. But there's a relatively small range that most people will like. The thing to be aware of when doing blending is some blends take time to stabilize and meld. Some of the compounds are going to react slowly. Maybe the oxygen you introduced in the process is going to take time to stabilize out. I mean, you talk to winemakers in particular, they talk about bottle shock. You had a really good wine sitting in a barrel or a tank, and you decided to bottle it, and it may take a week, 2 weeks, a month, until all of a sudden, miraculously, the bottles taste again like they did before you bottled them. It's the reaction of all the, stirring, shaking, whatever that happened while doing this. Bottling has to stabilize. There are protective compounds that react. Well, the same thing happens when you're blending. You got to let time pass sometimes for these things to stabilize out. So you may want to just blend up a bottle or two, wait a few weeks, taste it again. Is it still stable? Is it still what I want? Or maybe I need to push it farther or less to get it stable before I do the whole batch. I mean, there's a lot to think about, and unfortunately, it's hard to teach you exactly what to do, and part of it's driven by your palate. But in the interest of staying on schedule, we're supposed to go to questions now.
Perfect timing. All right, everybody, well, thanks, Steve, for a great talk. And we have time for a few questions.
Yes, Al.
Hey, Steve, nice job. Question is about adding massive amounts of fruit that have massive amounts of water in it, massive amounts of water in the fruit. If you're only adding a little bit of water to a little bit of honey and then this massive amounts of fruit, what sort of effect does that have on your yeast and your fermentation?
It does make it really tough. Like I said, say we happen to have a few hundred pounds of strawberries to deal with. The strawberries have a lot of water in them, and if you wanted to, end up only with 5 gallons of mead and you needed, 30 pounds of strawberries, you really didn't have much water to dissolve the honey in. This is one of the cases where I think it's beneficial to freeze the fruit, defrost the fruit. It's now pretty pulpy, juicy. You have a better chance of mixing it in, but even then, it's going to be a really thick must the first couple days because the water hasn't all been released by the fruit, and it is going to be messy. One of those little wands that you put into your drill to stir it up and get the honey into solution is vital.
You seem to like strawberries a lot, by the way. So.
Well, strawberries are neat. You can mix them with some bananas and maybe ginger.
Yeah, there you go. So the question I have is about the pasteurization. You mentioned that you can basically kill everything in the mead, but at what point in the aging process can you do the pasteurization, number one? And, I've got a 12-year-old mead that's wonderful right now. If I pasteurize that now, will it stop the aging process?
If you pasteurize it, you have almost eliminated every organism. There are a few cells that are going to survive the normal pasteurization, but they're down to the level that it's going to take many, many months for them to make a change in the gravity at that point. So if you were to take your mead, it was dry, you sweetened it, bottled it, pasteurize it in the bottles, pasteurize it back in your brew kettle and keg it, any of those techniques would work. You just need to be sterile once you pasteurize. That's why bottles work really good.
Yeah, it's been bottled, so I was just curious if it's too late to do the pasteurization or what.
So you can pasteurize even, say you wanted a sparkling mead. Pasteurization is the good way for that one. Because you made the mead, it was dry, you sweetened it, you monitor until one bottle's at the carbonation level you want, now you pasteurize the rest.
Now, is that only for sweetened ones, or because this one wasn't sweetened?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
I didn't sweeten it, so it just, is that where it needs to be?
Well, when you pasteurize it, it's not going to change after that.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
You've stopped the fermentation.
So I'd like to know what's your preferred method for
clarifying? Bentonite, polyclar?
I almost always use super clear KC, whatever it's called. It's the two-part chitosan and basically dye or whatever. I forget what the composition is, but it's the two-part packet. Works really good, usually in less than 24 hours.
Okay, thank you. And is that coupling with chilling at the same time? Or
you do not need to chill to have super clear work.
Okay, thank you.
And it actually works very fast at room temperature.
Hi, so you talked a lot about getting tannin from additives and kind of the timeline that happens on. I was wondering if you're trying to get tannin from a natural source like contact with fruit skins or wood or a tea or spice of some kind. Can you talk a little bit about the timeline for extraction there? Is there a point beyond which leaving it on the mead, you're not getting anything else out of it? What's the pH and alcohol kind of effect on tannin extraction?
You know, there's not a lot of data out there. It's something you're going to have, you know, different spices, different fruits are going to have different rates of extraction, obviously. And you're probably going to have to learn as you go, you know, what level, if it's getting to the point where you like it, take it off the fruit or the spice so you're at the level you want. Monitor it. It's kind of like barrel aging. You get to a certain point, okay, it's okay now. If I go any farther, I might get too much bourbon from the bourbon barrel. I might get too much oak from the virgin barrel. It's kind of your palate drives it.
Okay, going back to water content on fruit, I know like for liqueur recipes, sometimes they'll take sliced fruit or just whole fruit and put it in sugar and let the hygroscopic nature of the sugar pull that water out. Have you ever tried that with honey? Like say a bunch of strawberries or blackberries, and then you've got the water out and then you can bring it up to level. Have you ever tried?
I have not tried that. You know, that might work. You know, one of my fears there is most of the fresh fruit, of course, does have wild yeast on it. And in the process of doing that, you might get some fermentation going on that has some after flavors you didn't like.
Okay, I was thinking frozen fruit, then extract. But
yeah, it could work. I just haven't tried it. I don't know.
Okay, I guess I'm not the last. One thing I've never seen mentioned or listed is pitching rates. Is that anything to be concerned with?
Yes, pitching rate is very important. So I would go to MrMalty.com or one of the other yeast rate calculators to figure out how much yeast you need. I treat meads using the ale setting.
Okay, there you go. That was my
question. Calculators. Works really good for me that way.
I just had a quick question about the pasteurization process that you were talking about.
Sure.
I thought that was really interesting, and I've always kind of done the no heat boil method, and I wonder, is that something you need to worry about, losing some of the aromas and things that you get from the honey?
Well, obviously you're going to break, you know, things will change if you heat it up. You know, the preferred way to do this, my opinion, would be to say in the bottles, capped bottles. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put them in a hot water bath until the one I have no cap on with the thermometer in it says it's at 160. Then the rest of the bottles already have their cap on. The one that wasn't capped, that one's not part of my long-term keeping role. So I'm not going to lose a lot in the ones that are capped, but I may change some of the flavors and aromas because I got it warm. You could also pasteurized by putting the whole batch in your brew kettle and heating it with the lid on. In that case, you have more chance of losing volatile characteristic.
Right. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Well, another question that goes hand in hand with pitching rate. How about a dosing rate for sulfite and sorbate? Because the only meads I've made, I have
there's no fixed quantity of that. If you look at the typical references, you can find that, you know, we're all derived out of the wine community. The sulfite level you need, the metabisulfite you need to add, is determined by the pH of the thing you're putting into, because the disassociation rate is driven by the pH.
Right.
And then the amount of sorbate you need to use is a function of the alcohol level in the mead.
Okay, so you would use the same tables that they have for winemaking.
Yeah, I use the same settings they would suggest for wine. I treat mead as wine for all these kind of things.
Right. I just want to avoid over-sulfiting.
Yeah, you don't want to go over the top to the point where your mead smells like burning matches. That's really bad. Conversely, if you're considering being a commercial mead maker, you don't want to use sorbates because many of the outlets you could try and sell your mead into will not accept a mead or a wine or a beer that has sorbate in it.
No,
because there are people.
No, I don't want to get into brewing or mead making commercially. That's too much like slavery.
Yes, exactly. Are we done? No more questions?